Hello, welcome to the Paramount podcast. It was called Show and Tell, but now it's called Shambles. It's still kind of Show and Tell, but supposedly the shambolic nature was in many ways more eminent than the nature of showing and telling. I have to mention, I'm joined by Josie Long, as
Hello,
usual.
Listeners and people of the future. Hello, people who like the internet. I do not like you.
No, well, no, it's not all the people you don't like
no,
on the
no,
internet.
I'm just joking. That's I not mean, a come good on, we've all, I'll do it again.
That's a figure.
Hello, listeners.
We've all, I think it's important to have a certain amount of... Once you've got animosity...
Hello, the internet. I am ambivalent towards you.
You like it sometimes, though. You use it. I was very happy to find out that on Facebook, which I don't really use because I'm quite a Luddite, so I'm on some of the older stars of sight, that one of my nieces worried me the other day by saying, I think you've got a page on Bebo. I went, better not be. I'll end up on a list if that kind of thing happens. And we're also joined, our guest for the day is Mr. Robert Newman. Hello.
Hello. No, Josie, I'm guest. I've just jacked my chair up a little bit higher. I think you were just accomplice. I'm guest.
Well, you're like a Quinn Martin production. If this were the streets of San Francisco, it would say, with Robin Ince and Josie Long, special guest appearance by Robert Newman.
Oh, that's because that's to make me feel less bad about being below the title, isn't it?
You
get an older veteran actor plus special guest.
Well, you're below the title, but the actual your name is in a font bigger than the title.
Yeah.
It's the Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. That was
I'm
the one
next
where
to
they.
The title to shift focus.
Yeah, you have to peel something back to find your name hidden near the title. You're the Easter egg of the show. I was recently, there was four young schoolboys, not young schoolboys actually, they're quite old for schoolboys, they're probably 17 or 18, they're doing their A-levels, and I was on a Midland Mainline train, I think, and they came up to me, and one of them was an A-level physicist and gave me a physics joke, because he said, what book are you reading? And I went, oh, you'd be bored, it's a book by Richard Feynman. He went, oh, I really like Richard Feynman. And he went, oh, here's a physics joke. So I thought we'd start this one with a physics joke. Why are physicists bad at sex?
I don't know. Why are physicists bad at sex?
Because when they gain the momentum, they lose the position. And when they find the position, they lose the momentum. It's a kind of uncertainty principle joke, I think. It requires a very specific audience. It's like the audience I played a postgrad science do at Wolfson College, which is a Cambridge college. And I was really worried because I thought sometimes on the circuit, I can see members of the audience going, what's he talking about? Because they just don't get it at all. But on this, they go, what's he talking about? He doesn't seem to understand memes whatsoever. This is an absolute disaster. What a sham.
That worries me a lot because I'm writing a show at the moment about astronomy, and I've just got into astronomy and I'm trying to research it and I'm really interested in it. But I am aware that I've spent 3 months being interested in it and incredibly interested in it, but like 3 months, and that I'm going to be saying things and the sort of people who already love it are just going to, like, curl up with anger that I've said 65 billion as opposed to 66 billion or something.
I hate it, astronomy. I think it's just a load of old rubbish in space. It's not. It's dead.
What are you
saying? It's just dead.
How is it dead?
There's nothing there.
Well, so you don't believe
there's... Look at any star. There could be a planet on it with life on it.
There isn't.
What do you mean there isn't? What are you talking about?
There's nothing there.
The universe is infinite and keeps on expanding. What are you saying there's nothing there?
Hang on. Let's find out how much Robert Newman really knows.
What shape is the world,
Robert? I mean, how many suns are in our galaxy then?
I just don't care.
It's that kind of woolly thinking that has dragged you down. I would say, what would you say, Josie? About 400 billion, something like that, probably?
You see, this is my problem. I'm not knowledgeable enough.
No, it's not. It's just remembering figures.
No, okay. Have you never been to the planetarium?
I'm just not interested in all that stuff up there.
Yeah, but you haven't thought about it. If you,
and I'm not going to.
Did you think, is this partly because of, because I wonder that science can be quite boring when you're at school. And they don't tell you about things like, well, a lot of people, when you think of the Milky Way, you kind of initially, when you're younger, you think it's the solar system, you think it's the same thing, you don't realise, you see a picture of the galaxy and you don't realise how many kind of, you know, billions of stars are out there, because you're being taught about how much heat comes off a peanut or something quite dull, and it's kind of graphs and equations, and at no point do they go, the reverberations, the waves from the Big Bang are still going around the universe, and you go, wow, that's really weird, that's, or how long it takes light to come from certain stars.
I don't think it's because I was badly taught, because I was badly taught at most subjects. For example, my history teacher, who's now in prison, it's true, at secondary school, he said there used to be some controversy, but now it's pretty much agreed by all leading historians that Queen Elizabeth was a man. And that's why the makeup was very thick. That's why he, some say she, you know, courted Robert Dudley Adolescent, but at the last minute, no, courted Adolescent last minute, no. They cannot, because, and it turns out what we learnt, and obediently entered onto our O-level papers, the actual girl child had died, and so they'd had to swap it for a boy child so no one would know they'd accidentally killed Henry VIII's daughter, you know.
I've bought, or brought rather, a...
Have you
still
both
made
brought
that
things?
Mistake.
Have you both brought things?
We all bring things.
Oh, that's good. Oh, that's good. I feel less...
No, everyone's got to bring
less,
things.
Less singled out.
Oh, yeah, we're packed.
But probably... we criticise yours.
I'll ask this, actually, Robert, because you're someone who is deemed as being quite political by the standards of comedy. You do touch on comedy, touch on politics and touch on comedy. In fact, you embrace comedy and touch on politics. Right. Terrible introduction. We've had a big lunch and I'm 39
You've had
today.
A big lunch? I had a
which,
salad.
Happy birthday.
Which means I've realised I'm technically over halfway through my life as well. Because if the average age is 76, right, when I was 38, I was just halfway. Now I'm 39 and I was trying to work out...
What's every age, 76?
76 for a man, 81 for a woman. And I was just thinking, does that mean, is it downhill now, or by being downhill, does it mean there's just an increase in momentum and it's more exciting? Did you ever get worried about the fractions of your existence?
I'm not too worried about my mortality because I'm having a lovely time of it, and I think I'll probably be having a lovely time of it when I'm older, which I know is pathetic, but, and also, my grandma, who I loved a lot, when she was very old, she just kind of, just before she died, she used to talk a lot about being a bit tired and a bit wanting to die, and that sounds grimmer than it is, but made me think that probably by the time I'm 80 I will be more accepting of the fact that
you'll,
I'm nearer,
and you'll fancy an extended lie down.
Yeah, a nice snooze. My plan is to get fat as a house, right? Because now my plan for the last 10 years is to be at a weight that I was healthy about, like, this is in terms of weight. So what I plan to be, so fat that I have reading glasses on a string and they go to the full length of their string and rest in front of me, and that all I do is cook for far more people than I have, so that I can spend my entire life going around to people I don't really know's houses and going, I baked a thing, and then they'll be happy about it.
So anyway, politics, that's how, I don't know how we got onto fattiness. That was my fault. I apologise.
It was more just plans for old age. That was
plans. I think obesity is a good plan for old age.
Obesity and cooking.
Rob, have you got a plan for old age at all?
I always want to make myself a burden to someone else. I'm just frightened by all the ill health and everything going wrong, and I just think I'm sort of trying to escape, really. And I'd always had a romantic idea of myself just sort of, you know, being... I tell you, here's my plan, is that... So this is a more practical plan now, is that I've retired to a Greek village and I look like an old Greek peasant, and I've got all wrinkled lines, and I live very simply but quite healthily out there. And then I'm really just one of the locals, and they kind of forget that I'm not originally from this village. Until young journalists come up, they want to interview the great writer, and I talk to them and kind of amaze them. The young girls flirt with me even though I'm 80, and then the young boys, I kind of wreck their minds, and they have breakdowns on the way on the ferry home. That's the kind of the life I lead.
You've made a big leap from initially you were merely a burden, and now you're actually this kind of tsunami wrecking the entire culture of this small seaside village.
No, I'm a heather worn in their lapels proudly. I'm the writer on the hill, Syngraphius. There's the great
you do realize if you live that life someone will make a Guinness advert out of it.
But I think in the end you actually embrace doing that advert and you end up becoming a worldwide celebrity, and you kind of have this other wind, that, like Quentin Crisp, who was kind of, I'm just be quite happy to die, and then he went to New York and said, I'm having a smashing time, actually. People take me out for lunch and I don't have to clean my wounds at any point. He was meant to have quite dirty legs.
I saw him in the street in New York once, and I felt he gave me the eye. So I was considered something by catching my younger day listeners, and it was, so I saw Quentin Crisp staggering up the Bowery.
Did you ever have one of those points
that was
where...
like me and Dale Winton. I'm just joking. I did see Dale Winton.
Did Dale Winton give you the eye?
No, I bumped into him physically and I went, oh, you're Dale Winton. And then he rubbed my sides and went, yes, I am. Rubbed me. And I thought, gosh, I didn't expect this of
That's
you.
Kind of a good thing to be. I might become a famous gay man because then I could just rub young ladies. Girls up the side. Oh, yes, I am, Romney. How are you? And they just go, oh.
Now, I was going to ask you on the politics things because not that long ago, I went on a show that was meant to be one of those political discussion shows. But they're not really. It's one of those discussion shows like The Big Questions that Nikki Campbell does where they ask lots of people, what's your opinion on this? What's your opinion on this? What's your opinion on this? And you all try and be erudite. And then even if you think that you've actually won the argument just before and you go and that is why I think this should be happening and they go very good point but let's go to Mary and then they go to Mary and they go Mary what do you think and she goes my son died and they go Mary's won the argument and you go but it hasn't got anything to do with the argument and I wondered if you'd ever been drawn into that kind of world have you ever been forced to be a pundit on something which has ended up being a sad sack of nothing
I turned down because I know I'd be absolutely rubbish on them I think very slowly and I'd just be marmalised there and then I'd come up you know what the French call esprit d'escalier, the staircase remark. I'd come up with that 2 or 3 weeks later, and I just think I'd be really bad on those things.
You don't want to be the man ringing in to 2 weeks later when they're talking about Judaism, and you're going, and that's why wind turbines are a good thing.
I accidentally did one before Christmas, and I was so cross all the way through, and I've never seen the end result. But someone went that like, I looked like Oliver Hardy all the way through. They kept being shot at me, just kind of go.
I wish I could be complicit. I wish I could. Sometimes the amount of times I've been in those studios and I think, why do I always have to be the death at the birthday party? You know, just because I was a sort of into punk rock a bit, I have to go. No, I'm going to spoil it all. I'm going to not join in. And I just think, wouldn't it be? Whenever I've seen, I remember seeing Harry Enfield on some children's TV program, and he was just lovely with the kids and all friendly. I thought, why can't I ever be like that? And I always have to. Just think, I'm going to be... I just think... there's that happens. And the other thing is that happens is I can... You're chatting quite normally to the presenter and then the green light goes on and two things happen. One is you just... I remember just being, I think, on the news because I just suddenly couldn't think of anything. The brain fairy just come and stolen my brain and all I could do was look at the hinge of the glasses of the Simon Ogot and just thinking, wow, he's talking to me. I have no idea what he's saying. And soon I'm going to have to talk in front of this audience. And I really should try to... But that happens. But also the other thing is the green light comes on and this person you've been talking to normally suddenly turns into this more... So, Josie Long, comedy. Where did you get the person go I was talking to who was saying, I quite like Daniel Kitson myself. Yeah, yeah. And then he suddenly goes, yeah, so crazy. What's it about then? I think, oh, God, help. Where have you gone? Yeah.
Or they add something. So they go, so we're joined by a feminist comedian, Josie. And you go, I'm a comedian.
Well, I would like to be called feminist comedian,
but I mean, you're a woman comedian, right? I mean, I wouldn't say that your agenda is, you know, immediately if someone calls feminist comedian, if someone does that, what they're actually saying to the audience in a shortcut is going, I wouldn't probably listen to some of her crazy ideas. She represents in the same
way
that they went.
When we did that TV, because I really don't do any television, not that I get offered very much, but I did get offered ridiculous things like people we love to hate, as if I love to hate anyone, or like. Style mistakes, and you're like, do you not understand? I don't even know who these people are, right? But like, we did a panel show together.
That's right.
And I'm very
Sudoku. Neither about street cred nor Sudoku, but that didn't matter.
I'm just really scared of things like that because I'm scared of editing and other people having control of things that I'm in, and it terrifies me. And I hate the idea of things being out there that people judge me on that I don't feel very connected to or whatever. But that there was the presenter on that, and I think we had very different ideas of what we should be doing on it because a lot of the time he'd be like, all right, love, at me, and I'd be like, oh no, this is not all right, love.
Oh, you are a flirt. What am I doing? This isn't how Josie Long talks.
It was very weird.
The one that I went on, it was meant to be about secular Britain, and it turned out to be about who's taking the Christ out of Christmas, right? So I was getting cross. It was Nick Ferrari and Vanessa Felt. And the trouble as well that you have is that they pump out so many lies or fabrications that by the time they come to you, you think, well, I don't know what to deal with first. I didn't realise that Vanessa Felt at one point went, yes, someone has, you know, Christmas, it's not proper anymore. I mean, someone rang up my radio show and they told me that their son in the Nativity was having to play a lobster. Now, I didn't realise till after the show when it came back to me, she had either confused reality or the phoning call had confused reality with a scene from Richard Curtis's Love Actually, in which a child plays a lobster in the Nativity. So this had now become proper. The audience going, yes, that is true. People are being made to play lobsters rather than the baby Jesus. So once it came to me going, harumph, 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 grrr. And that's the point where I realised I'd made a terrible mistake.
Step off of those things, because William Blake said, you know, in Proverbs, somehow take your cart and plough over the bones of the dead. You just got to let them roll around in their own pile, you know.
Yeah, and no one's going to have watched that show and go, do you know what? That bug-eyed, shouty, gooey man who was slightly puce in the face, he probably looks like our leader. Yeah. Josie Long, what have you brought in today, please?
One of my favourite places in the country to do gigs is Hastings, because there's these guys that run gigs out there. They used to be called Don't Feed the Pokes, but they're not called that anymore, I think. They've changed their name. And this guy, John, who's really cool and lives in an old pub that he's converted and is a dude. And what he... Sometimes we... Because they film after a gig... This is so long-winded. St. Leonard's Warrior Square is so cool because it's full of second-hand shops, but nobody's... They're not opened in a gauche way. They're just sort of... We need to get rid of this big bunch of stuff from an old lady's house. And it's full of, like, little tea shops, and it's really great. And there's one that I quite like that's a weird... bazaar of lots of different sellers selling their things, and I found these postcards, and that these ones are really exciting to me because they're two postcards to the same woman from different people at different points in her life, and there's another one which is just very brusque, which I find amusing. But these two, one is sent from Tours in France to from an auntie to this woman called Eileen. And it's quite nice, and it's like, your mother is very lazy not to write me a letter. And then it says, Josie is asking for you, which is, I found very exciting, because that's what I know. But then the other one to this woman, Eileen, at a different address, which I assume is a later one, although you can't see the dates on either of the postmarks, which is infuriating, is from Newry. And on the postcard it says, this is a real photograph, which is so sinister. And it's like a nondescript, it's like the town building in Newry. And on it it says, hello, Eileen. I hope baby didn't cry too much after Maureen, which is so cryptic in itself. Like, is she crying for Maureen, or is she crying after what Maureen did to the baby? Right. Take good care of baby until I go home. Right. Has this person got the baby with Eileen? Or like, we don't know. And then it says, this town is hopeless. From R. Stewart. Like, this town is hopeless. That's it. Right. And also, then you think, so Eileen has a baby with this person, and yet he's signing it R. Stewart. Like, how close do you have to get to someone before they're going to be a bit more informal than R. Stewart? And
I like the clarity of opinions. Can I have a look? Clarity of opinions people had then. Like, people would use very definite brushstrokes, wouldn't they? I like this. You know, the Arab is like the Belgian, but with the dash of the French.
Yeah.
I can't read it. I hope baby didn't cry
too much after Maureen. But then this one I like. This one's from the 70s, and it's of Corfe Castle in Devon, or is that Dorset?
Dorset.
Perhaps this is in code.
Yeah, exactly. The
1933 is the postmark, and there's some German writing underneath.
Then this one I like because it's just so brusque. Dear all, weather foul, but food out of this world. Enjoying ourselves. Hotel great. Shaftesbury was fine on Friday. I don't know what that means.
That's the place, Shaftesbury, which is quite near.
Mick had a shock. Met his headmaster. Laughs, actually. Like, as if he knows, like, actually it was fun. So stop with your making assumptions every 5 minutes about what Mick's going to do. Because you don't know Mick, okay?
There's a lovely postcard in, which gets mentioned in, I'm sorry, I'm going to mention him again, Coral Sagan. In, I think it's the beginning of Billions and Billions, in which he talks about a postcard he's always kept on his shelf looking out, and his wife, Andrean. And it was just a postcard going, things going grand, and then the guy said, and the postcard is of the Titanic, and the bloke then was on the Titanic, and he sent that postcard the day that he went on the Titanic. So you always know the possibility of the end of life.
Oh God.
my postcard is a very modern postcard, and this is for your judgment, and you can decide. My wife had a baby about...
That sounds like it wasn't to do with you.
Well, it wasn't really. It's a bizarre... I mean, I won't go into the... But it is. You can't really do anything. So I don't like not being involved. And it was just... You could just kind of rub the back for ages and go, jolly good. Yeah, I wasn't that involved, apart from the fact that it was a cesarean then, and then I had to have... They have to do this thing now, skin-on-skin contact. And obviously, because my wife had a big hole in her, they couldn't put the baby there. And so I had him for the first hour and a half, which was just... It was kind of... It wasn't exactly petrifying. It was confusing. One, I kept looking down and going, oh, no, I think he's ugly. Everyone's going to be furious. It turned out it wasn't. That's what they look like. Their chin's reasonably recessive. And two, just on my own, just with this baby on my belly, just going, I wish someone would come in, because I don't know exactly what they're meant to do. And it's but anyway, so my wife, this sorry, tedious story, but she decided to invite the neighbours round because we don't really see the neighbours very much. And I, like you, I'm one of these people who picks up lots of postcards, some of them blank, sometimes writing on. And she picked up this, she said, I've written postcards to them, just pop them through the letterbox. And I picked up the postcard and I went, ah, I don't think we should use these postcards to invite them round. And I'll see if you agree, right? So she wrote to, this was to number 83, and the postcard is for a film called Zoo. The tagline, we are not who we appear to be. It's a documentary. Zoo is an extraordinary glimpse into the life of a seemingly normal Seattle family man whose secret sexual appetites led to his shocking death. Ooh. Right, it's about a man who died after he attempted to have sex with a horse, with him receiving the horse. Do you think that should be used to invite round your neighbours who you don't know that well?
To look at your baby?
Yeah, or should you not use horse sex cards? It's a tricky one, isn't it?
Can I see what the invite says? Because if it says,
what's really funny is your wife's friendly writing with this pervy card on the back. Hi there, I was wondering if you fancied popping around for drinks, and I think they'd come round.
Well, I did tell
like
them
German
immediately.
Swingers, they'd come round with.
We've bought our donkey. Oh no, Nicky! But I suppose because it's just called Zoo and it looks like a picture of a horse. It's only when you look a second time you see that reflecting the horse's eye is a nude man approaching it.
But also, you don't want your neighbours to, you don't want, we are not who we appear to be with your neighbours. You don't want to sort of, and that's the danger with the neighbours. You have got this thing about, oh, hello, hello, and you have these little sort of Beryl Reed images of them in your mind, and then you don't want to actually, and then one day you sort of share a bus ride with them and you think, oh, I wish I hadn't done that.
It's actually quite an interesting film. My wife went, why'd you go and see it? I went, it was well reviewed. So I once went to see a film called Exotica by a guy called Atom Migoyan. I hope that's the correct way of pronouncing it. And I was really embarrassed. You know when there's a film that's actually an art house film, but to get people in, they put a poster with a slightly nude woman on it, and you want to almost say, hello, yes, I actually like French-Canadian cinema, because you go, I'm not one of the casual passers-by who's been lured in with the possible likelihood of striptease or sex. I'm actually a big fan of some of his earlier, more low-budget films. I am not a pervert. Hasn't you got Smashing Knockers? Why did I say that at the end? Everything's ruined. What's your show and tell, Mr. Robert Newman?
I brought in this box. I shall pass it amongst you now. It's a white box with a hinge on it. And there were about 2,000 of these made last year. And on there's a label on it with a sort of pale blue sticker. And on it, it says, Toolkit for Climate Action. It's kind of very exciting because you think you'll open it up and there'll be phasers and stun guns to make you invisible with the police are looking at you. And then, and it's just got things in it. And these were all given out at the convergence centres before the camp at Heathrow last year. So there's like maps of Heathrow and bus sheets, what to do if you get arrested, and direct action handbooks, and quite cool little designed agitprop based on the cards they give you on planes about, and it's ones that use those graphics, but to talk about that. And so I wanted to talk about just transition. This is this theory of ways of lowering carbon emissions in a socially just way, and there's these different theories of doing it, like contraction convergence is one, and then there's different versions of that. But it's because you all are good at abstract thinking, and I find it difficult to sort of, and the reason I write novels is to put flesh on the bones of ideas, because I find it difficult to think in theoretical terms. But on one level, it is theoretical, because it's the contraction convergence theory, for example, is saying everyone has a right to emit carbon, but let's say we're going to set a limit of 440 parts per million. Parts of carbon in the atmosphere per million. And so if everyone's got a right to emit carbon, then everyone has a carbon allocation per capita, every country. So if you go to a country with 100 million people, then you get 100 million people are allowed to emit, let's say, half a metric ton of carbon. And what's good about that is then people in Africa and sort of in the global south can emit more, and people in the north have to emit less, so that at this little point quite shortly in the future we converge at we converge on the same level, which means that you don't people in the global south aren't locked into poverty. It's just there's all these different things about of just transition, different ways of doing just transition, which because climate change hits the poor hardest anyway, and it's a way of moving to a post-carbon world without the inequalities of the carbon world. And the best one at the moment, they sort of say, so if there's going to be carbon ration in England, let's say, then you'd say the government would have, at the moment the theory is it was invented by this kind of jazz musician, Aubrey Mayer. The theory of is that the government would allocate, so it fits, so like a third of all the carbon allowance goes to the government for spending on fire brigades and hospitals. A third goes to individuals and a third goes to big business. And that's the UK's total carbon allowance. But then you could do another one, which a more radical one, which is say 50% to individuals. Do you know what I mean? We all get like a metric ton of carbon we're allowed to emit in any way we like, and half to the government. And then companies have to come to you. So Ford Motor Company say, look, we want to make a car, can we have some of your carbon emissions? You say, well, I quite like need them to do things, and actually I'm giving some of mine to granddaddy to make it and record another album. So instead of like buying lots of rubbish we don't need, they'd have to come to us for our permission to go and make this rubbish, and we probably would realize that we don't really want it. We'd have a choice. We're always told, you know, there's all those adverts that make it look like we're demanding things that they're forcing on us. So, like, it's the most common trope in adverts is someone holding up a placard saying, I demand, like they're protesting, but like, I demand 12 channels of Sky TV, or I demand better shoes from Camper, or I demand these beer things. But actually, no one's demanding this stuff at all. We're being fed it. And if they had to come to us on their hands and knees begging for a little carbon to go away and make their special fridge or whatever, that would be exciting.
I like the fact that when you were actually saying on their hands and knees begging, I could actually hear, I'm currently imagining the chairman of ICI and I'm making him run around my garden, and then if he runs around enough I'll allow him to stop. And
yes,
I'll
I must say
tokens.
I found that last pot of paint I bought from you somewhat lacking in substance and colour.
But how do this is it, because I think that is a fantastic idea, and what I wonder is at what point would we end up in that situation, as we are currently pretty much in hoc to, you know, big business, etc. Mm-hmm. And it's, I mean, you could now, I was thinking the other day about supervillains used to have to create an enormous laser to destroy the world, and now they can go, I'm going to destroy the world, how? I'm going to leave the landing light on 24/7.
Have you seen In the Shadow of the Moon? Oh my gosh. In the Shadow of
the Moon.
Oh,
is that the Ron Howard documentary
yes,
about
yeah. It's a documentary about the only people that have been on the moon, and they are the most wonderful old men you could possibly imagine. They're so bright and sweet natured and warm, and everything about them radiates like these smart, great men. And they're talking about like how beautiful the earth is and how you see it, and it's like this jewel and it's so precarious, and you look at the colours and how beautiful it is, and all this stuff. And you watch that and you can't help but be inspired by how wonderful it all is and how massive it was. And oh my god, the footage is jaw-dropping. And also the fact that at the end when they try and talk about conspiracy theories, and that gets just so upset that people will not believe that they went to the moon. And there's this guy who says, like, we went to the moon 9 times. Why would we lie 9 times? Why would we lie 9 times? And it's just, oh, it's so beautiful. And then I have trouble keeping a secret with one of my buddies. There were thousands of people working. Oh, it's beautiful. That is so inspiring, because these people, you know, fighter pilots, people are trained to drop bombs on one another, and then they get to go to the moon and come back and go, oh, human life is beautiful and precious.
yeah, that's a beautiful thing. But also the fact that you could go to the moon and come back and still be upset by some retard thinking you didn't go. It yeah. shows, you know, you do the best gig in the world, and then one person is slightly rude.
One person's
you,
like, I thought you was all right. I think Neil Armstrong, it might have been Buzz Aldrin, someone punched someone's spark out, like, for it. Like, somebody, you know, insinuated it wasn't real. Bam! Out you go. Like, I don't know. I can appreciate being a bit different, because it must be so annoying for them to go, well, it was all conspiracy. I went on the moon. You know, so bleak.
Well, there we so we end on the moon there. Robin, thank you very much for your...
I want to ask you questions about food miles.
What happens is that if you go there and you're standing in front at the little fruit counter and you go, I must say those Patagonian mangoes look very nice. Of course, cooperatively, if they're made, they will be... Oh, they look very tasty. There will be less carbon footprint than these apples from the next parish. Yes, I think I shall get the mango.
We're going to let Josie continue to talk about this, but this is the end of the podcast. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much to Robert Newman. Thank you very much to Josie Long. And thank you very much to Helen and Adrian for producing this. They're going to keep talking, and you might hear some facts at the end.
It's all consumption, if it's all about, there's never a thing about how you can change carbon as a producer, as someone who's most people's carbon emissions is at work, like in this studio, is probably burning up much more than we do.